But if he becomes vice president, the governor is going to appoint a Republican president. After a while, because that could be up to 2 years. But the point is that otherwise, you know, a Democrat would have won. Another Democrat would have won. So they tried to be clubbed in the Senate to be Republican. Good morning. Well, we indicated last week people wanted to explore a little bit of the morale. Again, well, we'll see. This may not be a long term because it depends on whether it's something that we're able to do properly. But I thought, now the morale does have a short sefer on Hanukkah, which is called Ner Mitzvah, and we could spend a few weeks on that. We actually finish, at least outside, a whole sefer of the morale, and then you could get a sense of whether it's something that is Lefi Ruchachem. But just a few words of biography generally. Maharal is an abbreviation, Maharal of Prague, Moreno, Harav Leib, his name was Yehuda, the Maharal. Of course, Yehuda and Leib always go together, not because Leib means lion in Yiddish, and Yaakov Avinu blessed Yehuda, that Yehuda would be like a lion, and therefore we talk about Yehuda Leib, and the Maharal trace his yichus all the way back to David HaMelech. So the Maharal's yichus goes back very, very far. He lived in Prague in the 1500s, towards the end of the 16th century. He had a very, very stormy life. People don't realize. People think of the Maharal, who wrote 30 or 35 svarim. People think of the Maharal as somebody that was closeted in a study all day, living a life of repose and reflection and writing many, many svarim. But the Maharal had a very, very stormy existence. He was fired several times as the Rav of Prague. They kicked him out. Because he was very, very vociferous against abuses that he saw in the Jewish community. If rich people were oppressing the poor, he would speak about that, and he got fired as a result. If people were not keeping mitzvahs properly, he openly gave mussar about these things. In fact, even in his book on Hanukkah, there's a very long digression on people who don't keep the laws about wine that's touched by non-Jews. It's hard to know why he sticks it in the middle of that, but he has some association which we'll get to. And as a result, he was actually fired from his position several times, but eventually they always asked him back. In fact, the last time he took the position, he was already in his late 80s, and they asked him back after an absence of 10 or so years, and he did come back. The Maharal was also very involved politically. This was a time of blood libels. This was a time of great accusations against the Jews, and the Maharal was very instrumental in defending Jews. The whole story about the Golem, which people know the most, it's a shaila whether it's true or not, but the Maharal actually had this Golem, this form that used to be his protector, etc. And according to the legends, the Golem is still in the attic of the Maharal's shul in Prague, and it's behind lock and key. Nobody can go there. And the story goes that during World War II, some Nazis had tried to go in there, and they were just killed by the Golem or whatever it was. But again, the issue about the Golem is still very controversial, because the story of the Golem first made its appearance at the end of the 19th century, more than 300 years after Maharal's death. And there was never any mention of it in any account in the Maharal's lifetime. So some say, you know, it may not be true. But I think the way we approach it is, maybe it's not true, but we believe it could have been true, meaning to say the Maharal was on a madrega where such a thing could have been done. Whether it was done or not is a matter of conjecture. But the point is, he did have a very, very stormy life. He was a person who was very involved in the community, both as a rav and as a posek, as a mochiach, as one who gave mussar, and as one who intervened with the government in very, very dangerous times. Blood libels, pogroms, all of these things. He had gone through. But what he's best known for today, of course, are the many, many svarim that he wrote. And let me just give you a brief enumeration so you have a sense of what he wrote and what the svarim are about. The first sefer that he wrote was a commentary on Rashi's commentary on Chumash. We don't realize this. You know that there are hundreds and hundreds of commentaries on Rashi's commentary. There are over 200 commentaries on Rashi's commentary, giving the sources of Rashi and asking questions on Rashi, and often the Ramban will ask questions on Rashi and give another pshat. So these commentaries try to defend Rashi's position against the Ramban, etc. In a standard Megillas Gedolos, you will see a commentary called Sifsei Chachamim, which is a commentary on Rashi, but the Sifsei Chachamim is really an anthology of longer commentaries on Rashi. The most famous commentary on Rashi was written by Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi. This is pre-Zionist Mizrahi, who was a great Rav in Turkey. But the second most famous is actually the Maral's commentary, which is called Gur Aryeh. And again, connected to Gur Aryeh Yehuda, that Yaakov blessed Yehuda as a young lion, and the Maral himself was a young lion, so to speak, so his commentary is Gur Aryeh. And this is written on all of the Chamisha Chumshei Sorah, all of the Rashis. And this was the Maral's first work, and in this work are the foundations of many of his thoughts as they were later developed. So the Gur Aryeh is a foundational work in the Maral's philosophy. Then he wrote a series of books based on the Pasuk, Lecha Hashem Hagdula, V'hagavura, v'hatiferes, v'hanetzach, v'hahot. This is a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim. L'cha Hashem, to you Hashem, is gedula. Gedula is greatness. Gavura is strength. Tiferes is beauty. Netzach is eternity. Hod is glory. And all is yours in heaven and in earth. Now, Kabbalistically, that's an extremely important pasuk, because that refers to the various spheros, the various manifestations of godliness in the world. Gedula, greatness, corresponds to what is called chesed, loving kindness. Gevura is inner strength. Tiferes is beauty. That's the synthesis of chesed and gevura. Netzach is eternity. Hod is glory. Kichol, again, and the other two are not mentioned explicitly, but there's foundation and there's malchus and kingship. So the Maral wanted to write a series of books connected to the themes of these lower spheros. Now, what we have is very incomplete, because he only wrote three books that we have. One is the Sefer of Gevura, God's Might. And that's called Gevuros Hashem. And this is the Maharal's analysis of Yitzias Mitzrayim, Galus Mitzrayim, and Yitzias Mitzrayim, in which Hashem showed his Gevura. So Gevuros Hashem is a very, very big book. It's around 70 chapters, and he encompasses all aspects of Yitzias Mitzrayim, Galus Mitzrayim, Yitzias Mitzrayim, including a commentary on the Haggadah, and including a discussion of the laws of Pesach. Right? So it's really a book. In fact, the book that we call the Maral's Haggadah, the Maral did not write a Haggadah. The Maral's Haggadah is an anthology pulled out from the larger Gevuras Hashem, augmented with additions of the anonymous editor. That's why many statements in the so-called Maral's Haggadah are not really from the Maral, and in fact they even contradict some aspects of the Maral. But you'll see that around 85% of the Maral Haggadah is a verbatim summary, well, it's a verbatim but selected passages from the Gevuras Hashem. So that's the Gevura. Now, the other book he wrote was Tiferes Yisrael, The Glory of Yisrael, and this is the Maral study on Matan Torah, which is the glory of Israel. So that's Tiferes. And the third book was Netzach, Eternity of Israel, which is his study of the phenomenon of the Churban Beis HaMikdash and Golos and Mashiach. So of the seven Sviros, the Maral only, well, we only have three books of the Maral on that. We have Gevuras Hashem on Yitzias Mitzrayim, we have Tiferes Yisrael on Matan Torah, and we have Netzach Yisrael, which is on Golos, Geula, and Mashiach. Now, once again, these are all, you know, big books, and the Maral gathers together Midrashim and Gemaras, etc., and he offers different interpretations of them. I believe that the Maral did write a Sefer Gedula, which is Gedula Chesed, and that was all about the idea of Shabbos. We do not have that that Sefer, and some of the other ones were never completed. So we only have these three. So we have the Gur Aryeh, we have the Gevuras Hashem, Tiferes Yisrael, Netzach Yisrael. Then we have a commentary on Pirkei Avos that is called Derech Chaim. Then we have an anthology of teachings on Midos in general. Like, there'll be a chapter on anger, a chapter on generosity. And that's called Nesivos Olam, the eternal pathways. So Derech Chaim is a commentary on Pirkei Avos in the order of Pirkei Avos. Nesivos Olam is a discussion of the Midos in and of themselves. If you want to know what the Maral says about modesty, about gaiva, about anger, about selfishness, we find separate chapters in the Nesivos Olam about these Midos. What's available in translation is, well, let me go through the list first, then I'll go back, because some of them I didn't get to yet. So imagine, you can see how the books are piling up, right? This is a lot of writing. These are not small books. He has a commentary on Megillas Esther called Or Chadash, a New Light. He has a discussion of Chanukah, which we'll be looking at, which is a small book called Ner Mitzvah, the Mitzvah Candle. He then has a long essay called Be'er Hagola, which is the Well of Revelation, and this was designed to answer attacks on Chazal. In fact, there was a book that someone had circulated talking about the fact that Chazal did not understand science very well, pointing out various inaccuracies, and also criticizing Chazal for the artificial way in which they translate psukim, or make drushas that don't seem to make sense. So the Maral wrote a whole essay explaining the deep wisdom of Chazal. So Be'er Hagola is a defense of the Talmud. And we finally have a work in which he writes on all of the Agadas, all of the homiletical passages in the Talmud in the order of the Masechtos. So you can open up Brachos, Daf Chav, and you can see what the Maral says on all of the Agadas. And now, you have to understand, a lot of the Maral is duplicative, although, because obviously, if he has a commentary on the Agada of Gemara, I mean, that's exactly what he talks about in all of his other books. So there are many, many cross-references and the like, but often he'll explain something in a slightly different way, and you can understand what he says in one place, but what he says in another place. So altogether, you could buy a set of Maral in Hebrew, the standard edition, and it would be around 25 volumes of different things. And now there's a new endeavor where people are putting out very, very extensively footnoted Marals. So therefore, a single volume will now be 5 volumes with all the footnotes and everything else. So there's one guy that's doing it. I mean, I don't think he'll be able to finish in his lifetime, but he already put out a few Svarim in multiple. So for example, Netzach Yisrael, which is one volume in a standard edition, is now 3 volumes in his edition. Tiferes Yisrael is 3 volumes. So he's doing these expanded editions with footnotes and cross-references and everything else. So eventually, instead of 25 volumes, it'll be 50 volumes or even more than that. Now, yeah. It's called Chidushei Agadas, just to commentaries to Agada. Now, here's the thing. What is available in translation? Not too much, really. There is an old translation that's out of print of the Ner Mitzvah, the book on Chanukah, which is very interesting. There's a translation of Gevuros Hashem by Yetzias Mitzrayim, and there are also translations of the Maral's Haggadah, but again, as I indicated, the Maral's Haggadah is not 100% from the Maral, although most of it is taken from the Gevuros Hashem. Art Scroll has published an adaptation translation of the commentary on Pirkei Avos, Derech Chaim, and they have published very recently a translation, an adapted translation of Be'er Hagola, which is the Maral's defense of Chazal. And then they have translated selections from the Sivos Olam, that's the book on Midos. But they translated the one about Limud HaTorah as a separate book, and I think the one on Tshuva. So they're translating them as separate chapters, because each chapter could be a mini book, as it were. So people are translating it, but it's very slow, and there's not a lot that's presently available. What is the Maral trying to get at? I remember in Or Sameach, when I was there for a year, I was giving a shiur in Maral, and the one thing, and maybe I don't have a good answer for it, the one thing the students wanted to know is, like, you know, what is the point? What is the Maral getting at? What is he trying to do? And it's not always clear what he's trying to do. The truth of the matter is, if you really wanted to understand the Maral well, you would actually need to understand the environment against which he is playing off. He is responding to a particular environment. And that environment was essentially medieval philosophy. He is on the cusp of the Renaissance, in truth, when there begins to be a newfound faith in science and in reason. And yet he is also coming from a tradition, not just a Jewish tradition, but a tradition in the world of a certain type of scholastic philosophy, medieval philosophy, which in turn was connected to Aristotle and to some degree on Plato and the like. And therefore the Maharal, somewhat like the Rambam was doing, when the Rambam tried to reconcile Judaism with Aristotelian philosophy, that was the Rambam's goal in the Bor Nevuchim, the Maharal often tries to explain Jewish concepts by drawing on certain concepts and understandings that were current in the world as part of a philosophical tradition. That's why what yeshiva students often think are the Maharal's unique words, unique phrases. The Maharal always uses, for example, chomer, which is matter, and tsur, which is form. We'll talk about, in other words, the concept is that in a table, we have two elements. There is the matter of the table, which is just the wood, and then there's the form. And instead of the way we look at it, there's one table here, there's a form that is imposed on matter. And the form is the essence of something, and the matter just happens to be the accidental composition of what it's made up of. And people say, oh, this is the Maharal's chomer tzur. I mean, this is not the Maharal's invention at all. This is a common philosophical terminology taken really from Plato and the like. And the Maharal uses, to a large degree, Platonic terminology to explain authentically Jewish concepts. So to really understand the Maharal, one should take off 6 months and review Plato, more Plato than Aristotle. It's interesting. The Rambam was more connected to Aristotle. Maharal is more connected to Plato. In fact, even the idea that things in this world represent tangible embodiments of theoretical ideals, right? That this world is just a tangible expression of an ultimate reality, which is really a Neoplatonic idea. This is something Maharal talks about all the time. So, as a result, he tries to combine philosophy, science as it was understood, and mysticism, Kabbalah. Now, although he never mentions Kabbalah explicitly, but it's very, very clear that he's drawing a lot of his thought from Kabbalah. Yeah.
My brother, may he rest in peace, was very religious. And when I tried, as a child even, make him study English or arithmetic, or whatever, he said, this is bitter Torah and it's forbidden. How come the Maharal learned, studied Plato?
Well, the Maharal had a different... The Rambam studied all sorts of wisdoms as well.
Yeah, I know, I know.
Well, the Maharal was also a person who was not averse to secular knowledge. The Maharal does incorporate a great deal of science, astronomy, philosophy, generally speaking. So the Maharal is a difficult combination because he is combining science, as it was understood, secular philosophy, and Kabbalah through the prism of the teachings of Chazal. So the one thing the Maharal always does is that all of his works are very, very heavily built on Mamorei Chazal. That's why, you know, the truth is, even if one doesn't understand the Maharal, it's often worthwhile to learn him because of the plethora of midrashim that he brings to bear on the theme. So, for example, in a given chapter, he may analyze 5 or 6 midrashim. And even if one doesn't fully understand what he's trying to do with those midrashim, but he brings them together, and from the midrash itself, one gets a very, very useful useful picture. Right? So that's why it is difficult. And I will say that if a person, and again, I'm certainly not an expert in the field, but if a person does not have a grounding in medieval philosophy, one will have difficulty with the Maharal. So a lot of the unique twists in his lashon are really not unique to him at all. They are part of the stock vocabulary of philosophy in the Middle Ages. But as I say, the Maharal brings to bear all of this through the commitment that the words of Chazal are true and they represent truth, and all has to be understood through the prism of the Mamorei Chazal. Now, when the Maharal died and his works were published, his sons-in-law tried to assert that he was not involved in Kabbalah at all, and he never learned any Kabbalah. That's really an obvious lie, to be polite. The reason why there was such an attempt to cover up the Maharal's involvement in Kabbalah is that this was this already brought us to the Shabtai Tzvi era of the false Mashiach, and Shabtai Tzvi was able to attract tens of thousands of Jews primarily by invoking Kabbalistic teachings. So after Shabtai Tzvi eventually as you know, he eventually was imprisoned.
He
became a Muslim, and there are still people who continue to believe in him, and there are people today, the Dunma, that still believe in him. In fact, they want to come to Israel now under the law of return. They claim that they're Jewish. But nevertheless, there was a tremendous reaction in Eastern Europe against Kabbalah, that nobody could learn Kabbalah, etc. Therefore, in order to get the Maharal Svarim accepted, there had to be a point. He has nothing to do with Kabbalah. But it's very, very obvious, even to a very casual reader of it, that his works are very, very based on Kabbalah. The Maharal did have sons. The Maharal had sons who were great rabbanim. His sons-in-law were involved in the printing of his work. There's a whole story with the Maharal. His wife was also a very, very well-known person in her own right, Pearl. That there were different stories how, at a time when he was without employment for various reasons, she kept him going and encouraged him. There are many, many stories. They would learn together and they would share ideas, and there was a big sense that his growth in Torah was connected to her, not only in terms of the fact that she would work when he didn't have a job, but in fact they would actually actively learn together as well. And, there are many, many stories about her greatness. So this is who the Maharal was, and as I say, his sforim are often very, very difficult, so we only get like a little bit of the whole meaning, but we can usually get some meaning that we could apply to our life. And one of the great things, the Maharal is said to be one of the great teachers in opening up Agadita. You know, in Gemara, in Talmud, we have two portions of the Talmud of very different size. The vast majority of the Talmud, the Gemara, deals with matters of halacha, matters of law. A much smaller part of the Gemara deals with what we call agada. Now, agada is sometimes translated as legend. I don't want to translate it as legend, because legend means something that's not true. But these are these stories of various great people, either people in the Tanakh or people, the Tanarim and the Maran themselves, or these are the ethical teachings or the philosophical teachings and like. Now, if you would compare this, we would have to say four-fifths of the Talmud is halacha, and around one-fifth of the Talmud in terms of pages are agada. Now, the agada was then printed separately in a series of volumes that are called Ein Yaakov. But what is the Ein Yaakov? The Ein Yaakov, it's not the Medrash. The Ein Yaakov is taken from the Gemara. It is simply the anthology of the agadic passages from the Gemara. So if you look, for example, you'll see a standard Babylonian Talmud is 20 volumes, and a standard Ein Yaakov is 5 volumes. That's exactly it, 5 or 4 volumes. And that's the ratio of Agada. Now, the reason why it was printed separately is because it was thought that Ein Yaakov is the easier stuff. Ein Yaakov are the stories, etc. So even in Eastern Europe, it was common between Mincha and Maariv when you had the uneducated shoemaker who would come in and want to learn for 15 minutes. They would give a class in Ein Yaakov, right? An Ein Yaakov shir. It almost became a semi term of derision. Oh, you're going to the Ein Yaakov class, etc. Now, typically, in a yeshiva, where you know,
that was Ein Yaakov.
Say, oh yeah, we have Ein Yaakov.
No, I mean, no,
we're doing Maharal. We're doing deep stuff here. This is what I want to correct. Now, typically, if you go to a yeshiva where they give, let's say, an advanced Gemara class, right, really advanced with all commentaries, so the way it's going to work is that on a page that deals with halacha, the Rebbe may spend, you know, a week every day going over something in depth, and then the agada, then you'll have, see, in the Gemara, the agada is often a break because you're going from page after page of real complicated things, and then the agada is supposed to relax you a little bit. So the Rebbe will either skip it totally and say, you know, do it on your own, or they'll just read it with no commentary at all. So there was a sense, there had been a sense, that Agada was just a bunch of stories, nice stories, to give you a break, etc. And there was no particular inner depth and meaning that one got. So one of the great, great expositors who smashed that belief and revealed the tremendous depths of Agada is the Maharal. I mean, and to this very day, although there are many commentaries on Agada, the Maharal was considered to be the great founder of showing the depths. And in order to do this, the Maharal does adopt an approach in which many, many Agados are not meant to be taken in a physical, literal sense, but they are symbolic of spiritual truths. And therefore, when you read about Vashti having a tail, the Maral says Vashti had a tail. It says that Vashti didn't go to Ahasuerus. The Maral says those things don't mean Vashti had a tail, but rather it refers to certain spiritual impediments in her inability to go to Ahasuerus. In other words, and we'll see this as we go along, but what he says is that, in fact, this is an issue that I think we have with teaching our own children. It's an issue. I read about this medrash in particular. There was a fellow in Los Angeles who's very involved in Kiruv. And he says he's always afraid because his kids go to, his kids are in second grade, third grade, and they come home with a very, very, you know, amazing midrashim about things. But, you know, when you're talking to a 35 or 40-year-old person who's not from, they're not going to accept things that don't seem to make sense. So he's always afraid, oh, is it, are my kids going to say this thing about Vashti with a tail? You know, because, and, but basically, the idea is that the Maral does reveal that agados are not just stories, but agados reflect very deep spiritual truths. Mm-hmm. And they often give a mashal to explain the Maral, although Maral himself does not give this mashal, but it's a very beautiful mashal, that in all writing, vivid metaphors are often used to bring out an idea. He says, this is an example they give in contemporary sense. Let's say that a king or a government signs a decree that banishes all Jews, or puts all Jews in ghettos or concentration camps. So the way the New York Post might put the headline the next day is, a drop of ink drowned 3 million people. Meaning the ink, the other proclamation. Now, somebody looks at that 100 years later and says, oh, a drop of ink drowns 3 million people? That's so ridiculous. Everybody knows a drop of ink cannot drown 3 million people. But the point is, that's a very vivid way. In other words, the signature of the Melech condemns 3 million people. The Maral basically says that Agadata often talks that type of language. There's a certain punch to it. And therefore, stories about the drop of ink drowning 3 million people or whatever are not meant to be taken in a literal way, but they're meant to be understood as reflecting some inner essence. And then you have to delve into what that inner essence is. And therefore the Maral was really the first, because the truth is, even the Rambam writes that agadas are not always meant to be absolutely literal. And the Rambam wrote that he wanted to write a commentary on agada, but he never got to it. So we don't have a commentary from the Rambam. But the Maral, both in terms of a set of books on agada, but the truth is, every single sefer, I mean the Maral, you can look at the whole corpus of the Maral's work, every sefer, as simply exploring the innermost depths of Chazal in the Gemara and also in the Medrash. So for example, although for some reason not in this book, this is the Ner Mitzvah book, but in the books of the Maral, when they put out indexes of Midrashim and Gemara, so you can see that in every book, you know, he explains 20, 30, 50 Midrashim, etc. Right? So, I mean, this is really the Maral's goal. Now, some historians say that the Maral's main goal was to be a philosopher, and he just uses the Midrashim as kind of tools to expound his philosophy, but I think it's exactly the opposite. His main goal was to explain the depth of the words of the Chachamim, and he used the philosophical tools of his day to try to explain them. So, people like Rav Dessler, the Michtav Melio, Rav Huttner, these are modern people, all of them are very, Rav Gedalia Shor, all of them are very, very heavily in the Maral's debt. Chassidus, the Maral was pre-Baal Shem Tov. Mm-hmm. He was before the Baal Shem Tov. There was no Chassidic movements in the Maral's time, but the Maral is often considered to be the spiritual father of Chassidus in many different ways. One way was in his emphasis on the Haggadic portions of the Torah as a basis for spiritual value, because that was often denigrated in the Litvisha non-Hasidic tradition. And number two, in his emphasis on inner devotion, that it's not enough to do mitzvahs externally. Now again, that's in Yeshayahu too, mitzvahs anashim ulumada, but the emphasis on lev that we will see a lot. So in many ways he was considered to be the spiritual father of Hasidus, and it's well known that the earlier Hasidic rebbes drew extensively from the Maral. Now there was a long period where the Maral's writings were almost forgotten. They were out of print, they were not learned very much, etc. And I think basically for almost 200 or 250 years, but then Rav Huttner and other Gedolim kind of rediscovered the Maharal, and today he is used really in all the yeshivas. I mean, not everybody understands what the Maharal is writing about, but everybody tries to learn him a little bit. I'm sorry, Julie. Oh, they themselves?
Yeah.
Well, the Agadot in the Gemara are the same rabbis in the Gemara. These are the Tanoim of the Mishnah, the Amoraim. They said these things. And the Midrashim too. The Midrashim are of the same age as the Gemara itself. And the same people. Now, the Agadot, the Ramban already says, the Agadot are not necessarily, they were not given by Hashem to Moshe and Har Sinai. These are the individual interpretations. And it's unlike halachas that might go all the way back. These are the, just like somebody would give a drasha today. They gave a drasha, but of course they gave a drasha out of their Ruach HaKodesh, out of their greatness. But it is their own understanding. But still, if you have emunah in their greatness and in their kedusha, then their understanding of Hashem's will is something that we have to strive to understand. But it's not like a direct thing that Hashem gave to Moshe. That's right. You open up a, right, is a separate set of works. Yeah, that's correct. No, these are two separate works. The Gemara or the Talmud has within it a lot of Agada. So if you open up a page of Talmud, you know, it's Agada, it's all mixed in. The Ein Yaakov took out the Agada and printed it separately, but it's still in the Gemara. Medrash is a separate body of work, which is all Agada, basically. And there are different collections of Medrash. There's the Medrash Rabbah, which is the largest Medrash, and that's organized on the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. So there's Bereishis Rabbah, Shemot Rabbah, Vayikra Rabbah, Bamidbar Rabbah, Dvarim Rabbah, and on the five Megillas, Esther Rabbah, etc. Then there's the Medrash Tanchuma, which is only on Chumash. Then there's the Yalkut Shimoni, which is a collection of Midrashim on all of Tanakh. A lot of these overlap, but a lot of them are, you know, are different as well. And these are Midrashim, but all of them date from the era of Chazal, the Tanoim, the Amoraim, etc., which deals, I guess, from the time of the second Beis Hamikdash till around the second century. So you're dealing with around 600 or 700 years of activity. And collectively, we often call that Agadata, although Agadata is sometimes used only for what's in the Gemara, and sometimes Agadot is used for the whole corpus of non-legal legal work. Does that make sense? Which of the Medrash you mean? Well, these are different books. Certainly, you know, if you take a... Well, in English, the only translation of the Medrash Rabbah as a work is Sansino. Sansino translated the entire Medrash Rabbah many years ago. Medrash Tanchuma has never been translated. Yalkut Shimoni has not been translated. Now, if you take even a popular work like the Medrash Says is an adaptation that is drawn from Medrash Rabbah, Medrash Tanchuma, Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, Yalkut Shimoni. Right? In other words, so when you say the Medrash says, what is the Medrash? The Medrash, there are many books that are Medrash, right? In addition to Agadot in the Gemara, right? So the Ein Yaakov, right? So many people find that something like the Medrash says is a more useful tool just to get Midrashim because it brings things together. In fact, Professor Lewis Ginsberg compiled the Legends of the Jews, which is... actually, a very, very excellent. He took it from everything. If you look at his footnotes, it's a six-volume work. Three volumes are footnotes. So, in other words, he looked at hundreds. There are hundreds of midrashim that he looked at. I mentioned four or five of the more common ones. Yeah.
How did Bialik Sefer HaGadah fit in?
Well, Sefer HaGadah, once again, was also a very, very nice work, although I don't like the front piece picture. You know, it shows, it was Bialik and Ravnitsky put together an anthology of Agada. So in the picture they showed them, I hope it wasn't Shabbos, they showed them both smoking, sitting with us, sitting with yarmulkes as they're doing their work. But it's an anthology like from Gemara, from Medrash. He took from Gemara and from Medrash, organized thematically. But it's just another anthology from those works. Yeah.
What you're saying though is Midrash is not Torah Sinai.
Midrash is not Mi Sinai.
Well, then, why is some of like this being taught in certain places? They take Midrashim as if they were, you know, 100%.
Well,
somebody parked in such a manner, the last car in there, that's blocking up anybody from leaving, so I appreciate it. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine.
There are about four cars that want to get out.
Okay. That is an issue that's being discussed right now. I even saw an article by Shmuel Kamenetsky, in which he talked about the problems and how we approach Medrash. The problem is that you want to avoid two extremes. On one hand, that it's Misinai, etc., is a bit of a distortion. But the problem is, that leads us sometimes to the opposite idea, that people feel, if it's not Misinai, it's Baba Mises. See, that's what the Maral was trying to dispute, that it has Kedusha, it has significance, it has meaning, it is part of Yiddishkeit, it is our Mesorah from Chazal. So the truth is, you got to try to steer a mid-course, that it's not Misinai, but it's not Baba Mises that you just dismissed, because Chas V'Shalom. And therefore, I would have to say this, if you had to make a choice, if those were the two evils, either or, I would rather have them have an attitude of greater deference than to have a lack of respect. So it could be that we're trying to avoid the greater evil of the other way. But you are correct. Technically, there's a certain inaccuracy in having to regard this as Misinai. In fact, this was one point the Ramban himself made. When the Ramban had a public debate with one of the priests, and we have a record of his debate. So the priest was bringing various midrashim, showing that there was a Jesus would come, and said, and the Ramban just said, it's a midrash, we don't have to accept this as Misinai. So the Ramban himself said such a thing. Well, the people later said he was just saying it to get the guy off his back, he didn't mean it, but I think we have to assume the Ramban meant what he said. Yeah.
What was the purpose of the Agadot? Because some of them are so difficult.
Yeah.
So if the purpose was like, let me tell you a story so you'll be more interested, they're very difficult to understand.
Right. So the Maral says that Agadot had many, many purposes. The primary purpose was to inspire people. The concept was halachas were considered the body of Judaism. This is what a body does, the physical thing. And the agada was the soul. It was to inspire a person with love of Hashem, fear of Hashem, to develop midos of kindness and courage against the Yetzer Hara, etc. And Chazal would often convey these teachings through the medium of a story, because a story would be something that interested, just like today. A story interests a person. The Maral says, however, that agadas were also a mechanism to convey esoteric wisdom to people who are in a very high madrega, and therefore those who were not able to understand it, the message was masked a little bit. So there's a simple meaning and a deeper meaning, and both are trying to be conveyed. The Gemara tells us, even in the time of Chazal, there were certain rabbis who were specialists in halacha, and certain rabbis who were specialists in agada. In fact, Rabbi Akiva was known to be a specialist in halacha, and we sometimes find in the Gemara, when Rabbi Akiva tries to offer a homiletic medrash, he is told by one of his colleagues, Akiva, you should stick to halacha, this is not for you. Even Rabbi Akiva was sometimes told not to get involved in this. And the Gemara tells us a story about two rabbis came to the town. One rabbi was a great, great expert in halacha, and when he gave his shir on Shabbos, very few people came. And the other rabbi, you can imagine the same thing happening today. The other rabbi was a great, wonderful storyteller with parables, and he had everybody coming. And the Baal Halacha felt very disheartened. He says, nobody comes to me. So the Baal Agada came up with a nice parable to make him feel good. And he said, two people come to town. One is selling the most precious diamonds, and he gets very few buyers. Nobody can afford it. And somebody is selling cheap pots and pans, and everybody comes. He says, I have pots and pans, I get everybody. You have the most precious diamonds, and most people cannot. So he came up with a story to make him feel good. But this was agada. So on one level, that's why it's a little complicated, on one level agada is supposed to be easier, but on a deeper level agada is harder, because it's dealing with very, very deep matters of feeling. And that's why Chazal say that if one wants to have Yiras Hashem and Avas Hashem, he should devote himself to the study of agada. And they say, in many circles, agada was disparaged as for being balabatim who were not learned. But they say the Maral and people who followed him tried to reveal to us the great depths of agada.
I think it's fantastic teaching. I think it's one of the reasons why I love going achieve a different torrent when I was here, which was like multi-tiered. So
right.
You could get the real egregious, you knew it was not, it was a great story.
Right, right, right.
You sort of remember it.
Right.
So in a way, it's really...
That's right, that's right. In fact, this is Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman of Breslov, who was much later, said the reason he taught by stories is, he says, if you understood my message, that was good, and if you didn't, you got a story, you got a good story out of it, so you wouldn't lose, as opposed to teaching a teaching directly. If you didn't get the teaching, you didn't get anything out of it. So this is what, if we had to indicate what the Maharal's great contribution was, maybe over and above the teachings that he articulates, was the sense that Agadah has to be approached. I mean, after the Maharal, no one could ever approach Agadata in the same light-headed way as perhaps one did before him. And that itself is a very, very important contribution to you know, Judaism and how we view the Torah. And that's why today, you know, you find many people in the advanced yeshivas and kollelim that will involve themselves heavily in Agadata, largely from the Maharal's influence. Okay, so that's a little bit of introduction to what this is about. So in Hanukkah, which we'll spend, you know, until Hanukkah, I guess we'll learn the Maharal in Hanukkah, and we'll see how you like it. The book on Hanukkah is called A Ner Mitzvah. Ner Mitzvah means the mitzvah candle. It's a very good name for a book on Hanukkah, because Hanukkah involves a mitzvah of lighting a candle. In particular, though, the word ner mitzvah is taken from a verse in Mishlei, and the verse is, ki ner mitzvah v'torah or. A mitzvah is like a candle. It gives you light, and the Torah is like light. And in fact, the Gemara itself makes a whole point. A mitzvah is compared to a candle, but the Torah is compared to light. What's the comparison? So the Gemara says the following, that a candle only gives you light while it's burning. Eventually the candle burns out. A mitzvah gives you spiritual protection, but eventually it may dissipate, meaning to say the protection of a mitzvah does not last forever. When you stop doing the mitzvah, you're not protected anymore. But, or the phenomenon of light in general, this is light that's not connected to a particular source, protects you because it's always there. It says Torah, Limud HaTorah can protect a person even when he's not learning. A mitzvah protects you while you're doing the mitzvah. Torah protects you even when you're not learning Torah. Yeah.
My favorite story, a man goes up heaven and it's very dark. And he says, God, I don't see my hands. Well, why am I so in dark? Right. Because we have a law. Each time you make a mitzvah here, we make a candle up there.
Right.
You have no mitzvahs, no candles.
No candles. Okay, well, that's going to be true. But the Maharal basically uses Ner Mitzvah, this book on Hanukkah, to discuss a phenomenon that's not directly linked to Hanukkah. There are three themes in this book. Theme number one is, this is the main discussion of the Maharal in his writings on the theme of the four Malchios, the four kingdoms that enslaved the Jewish people. What are the four kingdoms? We don't have Egypt. Egypt was before we were redeemed. But we have Babel, Babylonia, that destroyed the first temple.
Sure.
And Babylonia was then conquered by Persia. That was Ahasuerus. And Persia was eventually conquered by Alexander the Great, who is, although he's Macedonia, but he's connected to Greece. And the Greek Empire was eventually conquered by the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire eventually destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash. And therefore we talk about the Jewish people being in four levels of Golus before the coming of Mashiach: Golus Babel, Golus Paras, Golus Yavan, and Golus, the fourth Golus, the Golus of Rome, is called Golus Edom, the Golus of Esav. We'll see why that is so. And even to this very day, for reasons we'll discuss, we are, although there are no Romans around, so to speak, the ancient Romans are extinct, we are considered to be in Golus Edom, the Golus of Esav. And obviously Hanukkah occurred when we were under the domination of the Greeks, but the Maharal uses this as a springboard to discuss all four Golus, and then he zeroes in and discusses the unique phenomenon. So that's theme one, the Dalet Malchios. Theme two is, he then zeroes in and discusses the uniqueness of the Galus Yavan, which is connected to the story of Hanukkah. And that takes you through most of the book. The book is not very long. And then theme three is he addresses some halachic issues regarding Hanukkah. And he has a long digression, as I indicated, on people who drink non-Jewish, non-kosher wine, which he connects to that story as well. Again, it's fairly amazing. The Maharal seems to indicate that even very firm Jews considered halachically okay to drink wine that was made by non-Jews. I don't know how they could have thought that, but apparently the Maharal makes it sound like it was a very, very common practice in Bohemia, where he was, for Jews to drink non-Jewish wine. Now, in... Second? Did I say there were four?
Three.
Now, in his discussion of the four Malchios, the four Golios, he starts off his discussion with two accounts in the book of Daniel. If you remember the book of Daniel, now who is Daniel? Daniel...